Travel between regions should be avoided. In red zones, it's also forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the specific measures addressing the situation. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Following the despicable attack on January the 6th, there must be truth and accountability if we are going to move forward, heal, and bring our country together once again.
The historic second impeachment trial of Donald Trump begins today for inciting the deadly January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. We'll get the latest. Then, where's the vaccine for ableism? We'll speak to two disability rights activists about growing calls to prioritize giving COVID vaccines to people with physical and mental disabilities.
Vaccine equity must include disabled, chronically ill, and immunocompromised people.
Then, the United States has just deported 72 people to Haiti, including a two-month-old baby, and 21 other babies and children, despite President Biden's vow to halt deportations for 100 days.
We are calling on President Biden to stop the deportation of Haitians in the middle of the uprising in Haiti. The inhuman, cruel, and draconian practice under President Trump cannot continue.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The historic second impeachment trial of Donald J. Trump begins today in the Senate. The proceedings will decide whether to hold Trump accountable for inciting the deadly insurrection on the U.S. Capitol January 6, which was aimed at stopping lawmakers from counting the Electoral College votes. Tuesday's debate will focus on the constitutionality of impeaching a former president. The Trump defense team's relying heavily on a law review article by Michigan State University professor Brian Cult, whose work was cited 15 times in the legal brief filed by Trump's lawyers Monday. But Cult told NPR his work is being misrepresented.
The worst part is the three places where they said, I said something when, in fact, I said the opposite.
Lawyers for the defense also plan to argue Trump was exercising his First Amendment rights when he made comments like these to the thousands of people who rallied outside the White House on the day of the failed insurrection.
We fight like hell, and if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
House impeachment managers and Trump's defense lawyers will each be given 16 hours over 2 days to make their arguments. The trial could end early next week if witnesses aren't called. After headlines, we'll get the latest on Trump's second impeachment trial. Georgia's Republican Secretary of State has opened an inquiry into Donald Trump's attempts to overturn Joe Biden's election victory in Georgia. Legal scholars say Trump violated at least three federal and state election laws with comments like these made during an hour-long conference call with Secretary Brad Raffensperger on January 2nd.
I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
Following an investigation, Georgia's Republican-controlled State Board of Elections will determine whether to refer the case to Georgia's Attorney General for prosecution. More than 1,500 people died of COVID-19 across the United States Monday, though the number of daily confirmed infections fell below 100,000 for the first time since November. Top infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci says daily U.S. vaccinations, now averaging nearly 1.5 million shots per day, should continue to increase as spring approaches and more doses become available.
Get as many people vaccinated as quickly as we possibly can. That's the best defense against the evolution of variants.
Fauci rejected a call by one of President Biden's coronavirus advisors to delay the second dose of two-dose vaccinations in order to get more people partially vaccinated sooner. Meanwhile, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg says the U.S. is considering a plan that would require all U.S. domestic airline passengers show a negative coronavirus test result before boarding flights. Buttigieg himself went into quarantine Monday after he reported close contact with a security guard who tested positive for coronavirus. Texas Republican Congressmember Ron Wright has died of complications from COVID-19 2 weeks after he and his wife were both hospitalized with the disease in Dallas. Just 4 days ago, Congressmember Wright blasted teachers, unions, and Democrats for delaying the return of students to in-person classes, tweeting, quote, "The CDC says schools can safely reopen if proper precautions are taken. What are we waiting for?" unquote. Congressmember Wright is the second person elected to the 117th Congress to die of COVID-19 after 41-year-old Louisiana Republican Luke Letlow succumbed to the disease in December before he could take office for what would have been his freshman term. Here in New York, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said Monday the Federal Emergency Management Administration will help pay for COVID-related funeral and burial costs for low-income families. Ocasio-Cortez says families can apply for up to $7,000 in FEMA funds.
When you suddenly lose a loved one, you're talking about an expense of $4,000, $5,000, $7,000, $10,000. And then during COVID, with overrun funeral facilities, et cetera, families also are having to deal with having to pay for the storage of the bodies of their own loved ones. This is wrong.
Meanwhile, a Columbia journalism investigation has revealed residents of a state-run veterans nursing home were given experimental COVID-19 treatments without the knowledge of their families. Residents of the St. Albans State Veterans Home in Queens were administered a cocktail of hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, despite safety warnings and doubts about the drug's efficacy. The Senate has confirmed President Biden's pick to head the Department of Veterans Affairs. Dennis McDonough is just the second non-veteran to lead the VA. He previously served as President Barack Obama's chief of staff and his deputy national security advisor. In immigration news, the Biden administration's reviewing the deportations of veterans and their families that took place under Trump. The White House said in a statement, quote, "The administration's immigration enforcement will focus on those who are national security and public safety threats, not military families, service members, or veterans," unquote. Immigrant justice advocates have long warned these guidelines continue to criminalize undocumented people and asylum seekers and continue to give ICE wide prosecutorial discretion on who gets deported. This comes as activists are denouncing the ongoing mass deportations of Haitian asylum seekers. The Biden administration had temporarily suspended removal flights to Haiti Friday. On Monday, The Guardian reports over 70 Haitian asylum seekers were deported, including more than 20 babies and children. Advocate and executive director of Haitian Bridge Alliance, Gerline Joseph, tweeted, quote, "We didn't vote and made all the sacrifices to elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris so they can continue Trump's draconian, cruel, evil and inhumane practices." Gerline Joseph will join us for more on the fight against these deportations later in the broadcast. In Colombia, President Iván Duque announced Monday Venezuelan asylum seekers will be given protected status for up to 10 years. The policy is likely to benefit some 1 million undocumented Venezuelans, granting them permission to work and access to social services. In New York, Reuters reports a recent federal court filing has confirmed right-wing Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez is being investigated by U.S. authorities for his possible involvement in drug trafficking. Federal prosecutors accuse Hernandez of using law enforcement and the military to protect drug traffickers. Hernandez reportedly accepted millions of dollars in exchange, promising traffickers they wouldn't be prosecuted or extradited to the U.S. He has remained a key U.S. ally despite longstanding accusations of corruption, human rights abuses, and involvement with drug cartels. In Mexico, authorities have identified the remains of 9 other victims, all Guatemalan, who were among 19 people killed in a massacre in the northern state of Tamaulipas. Of the 16 victims identified so far, 2 were Mexican and 14 Guatemalan. The 19 bodies were found shot and charred in a town near the U.S.-Mexico border in January. A dozen Mexican state police were arrested last week for their possible involvement in the massacre. And in Chicago, the former president of the Chicago Teachers Union, Karen Lewis, has died. She was 67 years old. Karen Lewis had been battling brain cancer since 2014. She stepped down from her position at CTU due to her health 4 years later. This is Karen Lewis in a 2010 interview with Democracy Now!
I don't think anybody will argue with that. That the system is broken. It has not basically changed since the 1900s, 1800s for that matter. And as a result, it has never been able to absorb real innovation. And the problem is, it's just a lot easier to test children. Our curriculum has narrowed in Chicago. If you look at the average day for an elementary school kid, it's reading, math. Reading, math. I mean, kids are bored to tears. They're hating school at an early age. There's no joy. There's no passion. And the results show that.
Karen Lewis's death comes as some 25,000 members of the Chicago Teachers Union vote today on whether to approve a plan to return to in-person learning during the pandemic. Union members have been on the cusp of striking over coronavirus safety concerns. To see our interviews with Karen Lewis, you can go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York.
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. Wednesday will be mainly sunny with a high of minus 8 degrees Celsius. Thursday will be mainly sunny with a high of minus 11 degrees Celsius. Friday will be a mix of sun and clouds and a high of minus 16 degrees Celsius. Saturday will be the same, with a high of minus 16 degrees Celsius. Sunday will be sunny and minus 13 degrees Celsius. Monday will be sunny and minus 14 degrees Celsius. Tuesday mainly cloudy and a high of minus 11 degrees Celsius. Well, that's it for the show. We look forward to being with you next week. Until then, stay tuned to CKUT.
miles apart. I look to the sky, I can feel your breath. You're so close to me, stuck in my head. The feelings we harbor were forged in steel. The space left between us shall disappear. The distance is no threat to us, my dear. You're so close to me, nothing to fear. When I look to the sky, I can feel you right by me. I feel the touch of your skin, the love within. I see the white of your smile, the bright.
I'm not sure what I gave you to give a life. This is Solidarity News on Radio Labour.
This is a Radio Labour Canada report recorded on Friday, February 5th, 2021. I'm Marc Boulanger. In the report this week, unions in Ontario are fighting to improve conditions in long-term care homes. The Labour Start report about union events and singing.
Close your eyes. Time to sleep now. You have someone to call to.
This is Radio Labour. In Ontario, the sluggish response of the government to the pandemic has resulted in many deaths in long-term care homes. But unions are fighting to improve conditions. C. Marie Ainsborough has a report.
As the Ontario Health Coalition conducted an online rally on January 29, 2021, it was announced that 3,941 elders had died in the province's long-term care homes. The rally to support residents and workers was attended by representatives of many organizations and unions. One of the participants was the president of the Ontario Federation of Labour, Patty Coates.
My heart is broken for our seniors in long-term care who this government refuses to treat with the respect and dignity they deserve. It's broken for the family members of loved ones who are in long-term care now. And my heart is broken for those in long-term care who have tragically died, each one who have family, friends, and connections grieving for their loss. It's broken for the frontline workers who are stretched thin and working in understaffed facilities, those who are receiving inadequate PPE, and those who are still waiting on pandemic pay.
Another participant in the online rally was the Secretary Treasurer of QP Ontario, Candice Rennick.
Healthcare worker infections have increased significantly since October. Thousands of healthcare workers have been infected and several of our colleagues have died. We cannot afford to go without proper protection because the government doesn't have proper supply to protect us against this virus in a way that requires to keep workers and residents safe. So we must demand that this virus be properly recognized and treated like an airborne virus. COVID-related deaths among seniors right now are occurring at a rate of at least one per hour. And the vast majority of those deaths, three quarters of them in fact, are happening in for-profit long-term care facilities. Why? Because for-profit homes are placing a higher value on their profits than they are on the lives of their residents and our loved ones. They are cutting corners however they can. They are staffing their facilities up to 17% fewer staff than charitable or municipal homes. And countless studies have proven that for-profit homes deliver worse outcomes for residents on a host of measures.
Also contributing a union view about the crisis in Ontario's long-term care homes was the president of UFCW Local 175, Sean Haggerty.
We all know that elder care in this province is in crisis. Every day we see heartbreaking stories about how COVID-19 has swept through long-term care and retirement homes, leaving far too many dead, far too many families grieving. Our elders have been isolated in those homes, knowing their friends and neighbors in those homes are dying, unable to see their families, and too often suffering needlessly in a number of ways because these homes, these home operators, and our government hold profit in higher regard than life. Our workers have been pushed past the limit as they try desperately to provide care without the resources, help, or support they need to do it. It's hard to believe, and I can't stress this enough, it's so hard to believe that this is happening here in this province, in Canada, but it is.
Representing nurses in the online rally was the first vice president of the Ontario Nurses Association, Catherine Hoy.
Today we're getting to mourn the heartbreaking loss of so many lives in long-term care. And we're all here to speak the truth. And the truth has a lot of power. And today we're putting that bright light on the roots of this avoidable tragedy. It didn't need to happen at all. And, you know, our mission today, I guess, is as we gather together, is to take back long-term care from the greed and the neglect. And we need to build the future dignity and compassion for our seniors. You know, today, as we remember thousands of lives that are lost to this disease, and they're lost to the neglect of the corporate chains, lost to the sluggish government response, shame on them. And we humbly recommit to ourselves as people in Ontario to never, never let it happen again.
During the online rally, the president of Unifor, Jerry Diaz, pointed out that the roots of the crisis were planted many years ago.
There's 30% less staff today working in our long-term care facilities than phase one. The government said they'll fix the staffing levels in 5 years. 5 years. You see, it's been this reckless and lack of respect. It's been these horrible policies that have plagued the residents for years. You know, I go back to the days of Mike Harris as the premier that deregulated the industry. And he should be ashamed of himself as a corporate director at Chartwell Retirement Residences, who's reaping and has made millions. Millions. He should be ashamed of himself. I'm disgusted with you, Mike. Disgusted. This has been going on for years. The Conservatives deregulated, the Liberals candidly did nothing to fix it over the 15 years. So now we're looking at another Conservative government and we're saying to Doug Ford, fix the mess that Mike Harris created.
The director of District 6 of the United Steelworkers, Marty Warren, made a suggestion during the rally about how things can be improved.
One most important option, I believe, is how does change come? What does change look like? And I believe it is an Employment Standards Act that needs to be created for long-term care. Where do I get this? I get it from, you can see in Quebec what they've done with one of their sectors, the security sector. They call it a decree. So it sets all the standards for the security sector and the wages and what have you. And I think part of the fix, the political fix, has got to be a separate Employment Standards Act for long-term care. And that's how we address the low wages, the understaffing, the training, the safety work, some of the safe working conditions we need. And I think so when we hear about all the change that needs to be made, I just want you to consider, what does that look like and what does that mean? And I think it should be wrapped in a long-term care Employment Standards Act.
You can find more information about the Ontario Health Coalition's campaign about long-term care homes on its site at www.ontariohealthcoalition.ca. This is C. Marie Ainsborough reporting for Radio Labour.
Now here with his report about union events is Labour Start correspondent Derek Blackadder.
Some of the big stories on our Canadian news pages this week included teachers in Quebec voting for a five-day warning strike, the creation of the country's first provincial-level bad date registry for sex workers in British Columbia, why healthcare workers of color are at higher risk of not just COVID-19, but the other effects of their work, and the new interest union organizers are showing in small retail workplaces like coffee shops as workers look to protect their health as the pandemic rages on. Regarding the prospect of a warning strike in Quebec, this tactic is one not much used outside that province and British Columbia. A shame, really, as it can be a powerful tool in a bargaining committee's pocket. Scan our Quebec and BC pages for a few stories about these time-limited strikes and consider whether your union could put this tactic to good use. Another of our top Canadian stories this week, the one about the bad dates registry, is just one of many indications that sex workers, not just in Canada, but globally, are organizing. These workers face not just the marginal legality of what they do, but also a high-risk workplace and the stigma attached to their work and to them. Sex workers organizing news appears regularly on our pages. So far this year, we have seen stories along these lines from every province except Prince Edward Island and from one territory. Like coffee shop workers getting together to push back these workers and what they are doing promises to be exciting to track over the near future. Canadian Labour history items on our site for this week included the anniversary of the day in 1939 when the first group of Mackenzie Papineau Battalion members landed in Halifax on their way home from their service in the Spanish Civil War. Many of the veterans were union members radicalized by their experience of the Depression. This week, sadly, we had to pass on the news that a maker of Canadian labor history recently died. We carried dozens of announcements, memorials, and obituaries honoring the life and work of Charon Gill, one of the founders of the Canadian Farm Workers Union. We've all lost a great fighter for workers' rights and social justice, a man sadly not much known outside British Columbia. Our condolences to all who knew him. Canadian stories on our Working Women page this week included surveys of the low-paid workers on the front lines and the challenges they face without social benefits to assist them in continuing their work. We also had stories about the price the country will pay if they start looking for other jobs. Canadian content on our Global Health and Safety Newswire included coverage of the demand that the federal government, and not employers, provide isolation housing for migrant workers on arrival. The call for this is no surprise if you've been following news of how migrant workers have been treated by their employers during the pandemic. Current campaigns that we are running at the request of unions around the world include an urgent appeal for online solidarity with the unions facing an all-out attack by the government of Kazakhstan. Look for details of this and other campaigns on our site. This is Derek Blackadder from Labor Start, reporting for Radio Labor.
Picture this. You're in the hospital with COVID-19. Your family is not allowed to visit, and you are not sure you will live through the night. There's only you and a night shift nurse. Here from the Labour CD Fallen Heroes, Songs for Essential Workers, is A Nurse's Lullaby.
Close your eyes. Time to sleep now. You have someone call to. The pain is gone. It will keep now for a patient and nurse to care for you. The ward is still. No one walking. No more tests to get through. Lights are low, no one talking, just a patient and nurse to care for you. May no one die till tomorrow.
That's it. Labor news you can use.
I remember being in a meeting in spring of 2011 with Sheryl Sandberg, who's the chief operating officer of Facebook. She was basically happy to take credit for the role that Facebook had played in the Arab Spring, putting her hand on her chest. And she was proud to just say Facebook had essentially enabled this revolution to happen.
For people around the world and the Middle East, Social media was how we consumed the 2011 uprisings. It was liberation technology, putting power in the hands of the people. I remember one of my first tweets back then was February 11th, the day that Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak resigned. And I wrote, "The world changed today." What's changed 10 years after the Arab Spring could fill a month of episodes? What we're looking at today is what changed on social media.
The Egyptian revolution made history because of the internet.
People seem somewhat amazed that they're able to see such a momentous event essentially unfolding live on their own computers.
It's a Twitter revolution, of course, a hashtag revolutions, if we can name it, that are sweeping across the region.
That was all 2011. To use social media in 2021, especially in the Middle East, is to navigate a maze of internet laws, surveillance, censorship, fake news, and bots. Many, many bots. Now, Facebook is looking for ways to make political content less visible on its platform. In January, Mark Zuckerberg said, quote, "People don't want politics and fighting to take over their experience on our services." So how did we get here? What changed? I'm Josh Rushing, filling in for Malika Bilal, and this is The Take. Today, we're talking to two people who work closely with tech companies in Silicon Valley and activists in the Middle East.
My name is Mohammed Najm. I'm the executive director of SMEX. SMEX is a digital rights organization. We are based in Beirut. We focus on the intersection of the internet and freedoms in the region.
My name is Jillian York, and I am the Director for International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the author of the forthcoming book, Silicon Values, The Future of Free Speech Under Surveillance Capitalism.
Both Mohammed's work and Jillian's put them between Silicon Valley and the Middle East as the wave of uprisings began. Mohammed says when he looks back, he thinks that's when our global phone addiction really kicked off.
I was thinking, since when we have this problem of like always looking at the phone and at the news? And I think it was around this period of time. I remember we used to wake in the middle of the night just to look at our phone and scroll down and scroll up and see what's happening.
Jillian had been working with Egyptian activists a few months earlier to get Facebook to reverse a ban on a popular page, We Are All Khaled Said, which called for protest on January 25th. During the protest, the Egyptian government targeted online platforms. It blocked Twitter on the 25th, Facebook on the 26th, and then, on the 27th, the internet went down.
When Egyptian authorities shut down internet access in an effort to stifle growing anti-government protests, their actions were condemned worldwide.
The funny thing about shutting down the internet is that by no means did it end the revolution, because a lot of people who were at home getting information from the internet then started to go out on the street and took part in the revolution.
Mostly, I think the real work that I did there was in connecting media to people who were on the ground. The very few people who had internet connection through that one ISP that was not shut down by the Egyptian government.
Mohammed said he thought that governments were caught off guard by the way social media was used during the uprisings.
Back then, it was still a place that is underdiscovered by the general audience, including the governments, including the security agencies. They did not link the internet to the activism and to a civic space.
It seemed like there was so much talk about how this new social media was being used in these revolutions that it almost really got overreported that they were the cause of these uprisings, that it was like the Twitter revolution. Is that a misperception?
Definitely saying that this revolution is Twitter revolution or Facebook is way beyond its limitation. I think it was people's revolution. I think there was a lot of injustice. There was a lot of unemployment. There was all the societal indicators that led people to do these kind of uprising. And social media was just there to be grabbed. There was a lot of coverage of the revolution because of social media. But it doesn't mean that social media has changed the facts that were happening on the ground.
I was very wary of those narratives, because what I knew of the individuals who were engaged in these revolutions is that many of them had known each other since childhood. Many of them had been organizers prior to their existence online. And so I think the idea that these networks made revolutions happen, to me, is not the point. The point is not even that they helped connect people, although they certainly did later on, but rather that they helped amplify and report on things that were not covered by the mainstream. And I think that really the greatest lesson from those days is how these participant journalists, citizen journalists, really are the ones who told that story, and I think who will be quoted and remembered in the history books more so than any of the major outlets from the time.
Jillian also said that changes to policies allowing violent content was an important factor in documenting the uprisings, especially as time went on.
YouTube, I think, was to me the most interesting one because of the quickness with which they made policy decisions in response to some of these issues. They banned graphic violence from the time of launch, but then when the uprisings in Syria quickly turned into civil war, they changed their policy rapidly to ensure that documentary evidence could be shown. You know, now it's a much more difficult question for them. And I think the rise of ISIS has obviously played a role there as well. But the companies at the time, I have to give them credit for quickly recognizing the role that they played, even if in some cases they exaggerated it.
In the 10 years since, how has that dynamic changed?
In the 10 years since, we've seen a lot of big policy changes at these companies. And we've also seen the way that these platforms can be manipulated by both state and non-state actors in really troubling ways. It's really interesting to look back at that history because in 2008, Eric Schmidt, who was then the CEO of Google, was actually defending YouTube's right to host content from Al-Qaeda. Of course, then, you know, after that, it wasn't just Al-Qaeda, it was then ISIS and a lot of other groups from all over the world, both designated terrorists by the US government and not always so. We saw a lot more terrorist content popping up on these platforms. And so Facebook had to sort of shift its policy in response to that and then create a policy against dangerous groups and organizations that became even more solidified with the rise of the alt-right around 2017.
She pointed to several decisions in Silicon Valley that stood out for her as key moments. One was about a video that made such big news in the Middle East at the time. It's strange now that it's faded more into the background.
A wave of violent protest is happening across the Middle East and Africa in reaction to an anti-Islam video that has been made in the United States.
The angry protests against the U.S. are blamed in part on an amateur film called Innocence of Muslims, which ridicules the Prophet Muhammad.
YouTube says it has now blocked the film from being shown in Egypt and Libya after the violence there.
What we later found out was that the State Department, the U.S. State Department, called up YouTube and asked them to remove the video because they were concerned that it was going to create riots across the Middle East. YouTube said no, but a couple days later, they blocked the video in Egypt and Libya. And I can't stress this enough, the Egyptian government, I can't speak for Libya, but the Egyptian government did not ask for this to happen. They did not ask YouTube to take it down. YouTube actually removed it because the U.S. asked them to. And so they only took it down in those two countries. But of course, once something gets taken down by a couple of countries, all of the other countries follow. And YouTube complied selectively with these requests. So these companies started making these very politicized decisions about what was acceptable and unacceptable.
That was in 2012. That was also the year that Facebook stock went public. Twitter followed suit a year later.
Facebook is launching itself on the stock market, and that's going to give investors a chance to buy into the company.
All eyes were on the New York Stock Exchange today as Twitter made its public debut. Energy was high, the floor was packed.
And right after Facebook's IPO, they opened their first office in the Middle East, which was in the UAE.
Today is a very exciting day for Facebook. We are delighted to announce our opening here in Dubai.
And it kind of blindsided us activists. None of us really expected that to happen. And shortly thereafter, they started complying a lot more with states in the region. Now, Twitter, I got a heads up along with some other groups at the time. I'm not sure I should name them, but a number of us got a heads up that Twitter was probably going to open an office in the UAE. And I remember us pressuring them not to. We sent them this letter from a dozen human rights groups, both from the US and Europe, as well as from the region, telling them this was a terrible idea, recommending that perhaps they consider Lebanon or Tunisia instead. But they went right ahead with their plans. And sure enough, Twitter then began complying with more repressive states as well.
Mohammed remembers that time too. His organization, SMEX, had started out focusing on how to help bloggers bring their content to social media. But in 2012, they shifted their focus to digital rights, just as Facebook and Twitter were shifting their focus to the Gulf.
So what should we expect from a company that should protect free speech to be based in an authoritarian regime country?
Do you think that comes from a lack of understanding of the politics in the Middle East, or do they understand the power and they're playing to it?
It's a mix of things. But mainly what I think is that these tech companies, thousands of percent of their user base have increased because of all these uprisings and revolution in our region. But now they got to a point where they need to bring money to these tech companies. And to be able to do so, they need to knock on the doors of the rich people in the region. And the rich people are the people in the Gulf.
From inside Silicon Valley, Jillian heard stories that she thought did indicate a lack of understanding was a problem, particularly around Saudi Arabia, around the time that Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, became an international figure.
I started getting information from people inside some of the bigger tech companies, and specifically from somebody at Facebook who said that when MBS visited Facebook, they rolled out the red carpet for him. They had the Saudi flag on video screens throughout the office. And one of the people who'd worked at the company also told me a story about when there was an issue, I think might have been a data request kind of issue. One of Facebook's higher up policy folks actually said, can't we just call up a member of the Saudi parliament, as if Saudi has a parliament, or an operational one, let's say. And so, yeah, I think that there's a real lack of understanding, particularly at the top. I mean, I don't see why anyone would expect Mark Zuckerberg to know much about the world at all. He's never even had another job. And I think that first the Islamic State, then the election of Trump in 2016, and Duterte and Bolsonaro and Boris Johnson and all of these other right-wing leaders, I think that's really when we saw these companies start to capitulate to the right and try to play both sides a lot more than they had been previously.
As tech companies were grappling with rights versus profits, Arab governments were also growing savvier at making the internet work for them. The years after the Arab uprising saw a slew of new laws that included new cybercrime and social media laws, as well as more sophisticated tools for surveillance and censorship.
We have seen a lot of people going to jail because of what they wrote on social media. We have seen all these new laws that have been approved all around the region, from like anti-terrorism laws that's been extended to include more online activities, to the penal code, to the cybercrime laws, to the new media laws. If you follow someone on Twitter, you might be penalized for this. I think tech companies, they need to look back at what they did in the last 10 years in our region. More and more of these countries, these authoritarian regimes, are taking the space. And we look now at Facebook, at Twitter, it's full of potential hacks. It's full of like intelligence people. It's not a safe space anymore.
Mohammed also said that the growth of bots drowned out a lot of the discussion. Where hashtags had once been banners for revolution, now they were targets for spam.
I remember friends from Yemen, they were telling me about how frustrating to use Twitter inside Yemen, because every time they use Twitter to complain about the bombing of cities from Saudi Arabia, from the UAE, blaming them directly, blaming MBS, blaming all these leaders in the region. And then as soon as they have a trending hashtag, like in an hour or less, they see other kind of hashtag supporting MBS, thanking MBS. And you got like 5-6 different hashtags that they are actually leading the Yemeni Twitter sphere. And so every time you go to these hashtags, you just don't see the point. Like all the good content are being hidden within the timeline because you have all these spams around you. They want to control the narrative. They want to control the space.
How would you like to see these social media companies change the way they interact with the region?
What we want them to do is we want them to actually believe the people who work in this region. We want them to listen. Activists or advocates, let's say, in this space are actually negotiating with tech companies. Every piece, every problem they have, they try to negotiate with these tech companies. They try to educate them. So we try to change their decisions. But like most of the time, their decision has been already made. It's rarely that they actually change the decision. I think the problem that they need to understand, these tech companies, is that there's no public space here. The online space is the only space that people have access to and they can express themselves. Most of these countries, they can't work in politics. Protests are not allowed. So the online is really the only space to use for that. And that's why they need to put more resources, because people need that. Unfortunately, maybe there's not enough money in that. But if they really want to support free speech, they really need to support the people behind it.
With the 10 years that have passed, one of the most striking things is how many people have simply left the online space where they were so active in 2011. I asked Jillian what happened to most of the activists she was working with.
I don't want to put anyone at more risk or more stress, but I guess what I can say there is that some of the people that I'm in touch with from Tunisia, many of them are still really engaged in politics, but some of them have just left the country and moved on. And then Egypt, of course, you've got folks who are still working really hard on this stuff. You've got folks who've found success doing other things. There's still folks who are trying their damnedest to make sure that these revolutions weren't in vain, whether they're working at research institutions in other countries or they're engaged on the ground. But you've also got folks who are spiraled into addiction and depression. And the same, of course, is true for Syria and elsewhere. So there's these stories of people who've pushed forward and are still fighting. There's, of course, this whole next generation, but there's also these tragic stories of death and imprisonment and despair.
How do you describe yourself in the sense, do you see yourself as a digital pessimist or optimist as you look to the future?
I am a realist. I've got friends in prison still for their use of the internet. So I definitely have a realistic view, but at the same time, I'm still optimistic, and I'll tell you why. After the Arab Spring, it was only a few short years before the Black Lives Matter movement really took hold online. But I want to be clear, that was another movement that was organized offline previously. It was always ongoing, but it really took off again this summer. But just to see the way that a movement that had started amongst youth, really, in the United States, the way that it had picked up and taken off all over the world blew my mind, honestly. And so I think that that's why I'm still an optimist, because it's still possible to do this. It's still possible to make things happen. The internet is not the organizing tool, but it is the tool that gets voices heard.
And that's The Take. On Wednesday, we'll look at how these same tech companies played a role in the global spread of the conspiracy movement known as QAnon. This episode was produced by Alexandra Locke with Priyanka Tilvey, Nikin Oliai, Dina Kesbe, A. Alvarez, Amy Walters, and me, Josh Rushing, filling in for Malika Bilal.
If only I could find myself, I would be all right. Questions surround. disintegrate in uncertain spaces.
Mercredi, le 10 février 2021, c'est l'émission Sleepy King Radio 97 et cette émission est dédiée à Richard.